Friday. That means we'll take your calls on just about any subject, take the show in just about any direction. For most of the evening tonight, for this first segment, we have a special guest on the line with us, Lieutenant Governor candidate Donna Bergstrom, running alongside Jeff Johnson under the Republican ticket, will join us in just a couple of minutes. This is Closing Argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you joining us. Catch up on past shows by doing a search for Closing Argument in your iHeartRadio app, and our channel will pop up for you. You can also check out our Facebook page, do a search on Facebook for Closing Argument with Walter Hudson. Give us a like. Set yourself to be notified when we post something. It'll enrich your life, and it helps us out too, so we appreciate that. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us as we freestyle our way into your weekend. Brianne in producing the show and taking your calls. Without further ado, let's go ahead and bring up Donna Bergstrom, candidate for lieutenant governor, running as a Republican alongside Jeff Johnson. Welcome to the program, Donna.
Hi, good evening. Thank you for having me on. This is terrific.
It's great to have you. I've been encouraged by multiple people to specifically have you on, which I can't recall such enthusiasm for a lieutenant governor candidate in any of the races that I've followed in my 10 years of paying close attention to this stuff. So you must be striking a chord with folks.
Well, I'm honored. That's really special to hear. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. So, you know, before we get into, you know, an update on how the campaign is going and your take on this political moment and what's at stake, let's get to know you a little bit more, because it's my understanding that you live up in Duluth and you've run a couple of times up there for a couple different legislative seats that have been particularly difficult to fill, given the fact that it is Duluth. Tell us a little bit about your background and who Donna Bergstrom is.
Sure, yeah, I'd be happy to. Well, I grew up in Carlton, Minnesota, which is just south of Duluth a little bit. I always say if Duluth was bigger, we'd be a suburb, but as it stands, we're not. So that's where I grew up. I like to say I was a free-range kid, hunting, fishing, trapping, you know, just kind of out there in the woods doing what we do up here in the Northeast. And then after I graduated from high school, I went to college at the University of Minnesota, which we used to call the Main U, but now it's University of Minnesota Twin Cities, and I graduated with a degree in political science. And then I like to say, what do you do with a degree in political science? And what I did is I went backpacking around Europe for a couple months. I think it was 4 or 5 months, something like that. And what I heard over and over when I was overseas was how fortunate I was to be an American, how lucky I was to be free, to live my life that I chose. And then when I hit about, I don't know what it was, month five or month six, I said, it's probably time to come back home. And I was running out of money anyway. So I came back home and thought about what I had learned while I was overseas, and I decided that I should join the Marine Corps. So I did. I went down to the recruiter and joined and went through the Officer Candidate School program, and then was commissioned as second lieutenant. And spent 20-plus years on and off active reserve duty. I was a signals intelligence electronic warfare officer. And towards the end of my career, I got a little involvement in the cyber security part of our defense system, and then was eligible to retire in June of 2010. And my husband and I were living out in Washington, D.C. with our then 4-year-old son, and I convinced him, even though I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona, to move back to Minnesota with me, because I said, I think it would be fun for our son to be able to grow up sort of in that same free-range manner that I had. And so we did. We moved back here in 2010. And boy, I'll tell you, it didn't take us too long to figure out that this was a very different Minnesota than the one that I left when I went into the Marine Corps in late 80s, 87. And just decided at that point that, you know, our taxes were too high, government was just everywhere in our lives, and, of course, being up here in Duluth, it was very DFL-centric, so there wasn't a lot of conservative voice around here. So I did seek out and find what I like to refer as my 43 other Republicans that live up here in Duluth, and you know, started getting involved that way. And I did work while I came back here. I worked at the Fond du Lac Care Clinic for a couple of years as a benefits coordinator. This was pre the Affordable Care Act, so it was a little different environment, and then we transitioned into that. And then I left that program and started working as a guardian ad litem for the state of Minnesota in the 6th Judicial District. And during that time, I obtained my Master's of Jurisprudence in Children's Law and Policy from Loyola University Chicago, and have been active in politics, like I said, since about 2012. In 2014, we had an interesting situation here in Duluth. The longtime representative for our state rep retired, put in, you know, said he was going to retire. So I was asked to run for that seat, and I did seek the endorsement. I did not get the endorsement, so I decided to abide by the endorsement, and ended up not running for that seat. But lo and behold, 2016 came around, and I was asked to run for state senate, and I did, threw my hat in the ring. And of course, you spoke well earlier, this being very blue, Duluth, you know, it didn't go my way. Mm-hmm. The numbers didn't roll that way, but in effect, it was a good run. And I really was able to bring a conservative message, and I think bring up some questions that not a lot of people talk about. Regarding education and the disparities and our out-of-home placement rates for many of our African-American, Native American minority children. And then I stayed involved. I got involved at our local level, so I am the House District 7A co-chair. We have a co-chair situation up here in our BPOU, our political unit up here for the Republicans. And although I will say I did take a leave of absence for these last 2 months, just so I could help focus on the campaign. And then in, let's see, I think it was around January time frame, I had been helping a little bit with Jeff Johnson's campaign. I will say I was very excited to see him run. I was happy that he was putting his hat in the ring again for us as governor. And come about January, I was contacted by his campaign and just asked what I would think if I was asked to run as his running mate. And so, of course, talked to the family about it and decided it would be an honor to do so. So I think it was May 14th that we announced that I would be his running mate, and we have been crisscrossing the state, hitting it hard, made it through that primary, and we haven't taken our foot off the gas yet.
I'm interested in your insights in the northern Minnesota, the Iron Range, Duluth. As you noted, it has been a blue area historically. You also talked about the changes that have taken place in Minnesota politically from when you first went off into the broader world and then came back. Mm-hmm. In particular with Duluth and in these past couple of years with the Trump phenomenon and the shifting of the political map that we see taking place, it's clear that something is changing up north. And I'm interested in your firsthand insider perspective on how the soil is being tilled, so to speak, up there on the Iron Range.
Well, you know, I think the first thing that comes to mind is these folks that had worked successfully in good and good paying jobs in our mining, our logging, those industries, and how those jobs have been, you know, shut down, aren't looked at favorably anymore, how this environmental suasion has really taken over. And I think folks up here, in particular on the range, are saying, you know, what's happening? We know how to mine. We've mined our whole life. We know how to protect the environment because we live here. You know, we don't want to drink polluted water. We don't want to have, you know, dirty playgrounds. You know, they want to have good, safe environments just like the rest of us, but they also want to have jobs. And these are, you know, generational miners and loggers and, you know, timber producers and that type of thing. So, you know, when people say, well, we've got to protect the environment, well, they're protecting it too. And we're at the point now, I think, where there has been enough studies done and enough evidence to the fact that we can do both. We can have safe mining, copper nickel mining. You know, we know how to do good forest management. Mm-hmm. We can do all these things and still live in our backyards, because none of us want to have that go away. So I think people have really kind of woken up to the last 8 years under Governor Dayton, where we've seen, you know, these are the regulations, and then halfway through they put up another regulation, or now you need to go through this wicket. And really what we have been hearing, Jeff and I, we've been out campaigning, is people are telling us in the business and mining and these industries, farmers and everybody is really saying, we just want to know what the rules are. We want to know how to, you know, what's being laid down for us, because we've got a plan for this.
Right.
And we can't do that, because we get halfway through a process and then the rules change.
Well, and speaking of plans, you guys, of course, are running against Tim Walz and Peggy Flanagan. And, you know, they've got plans, but boy, it sounds as though there's no real end in sight to how expansive and intrusive and truly oppressive they want to see the state become, and no real plan to pay for it. How are people supposed to adjust to that?
Well, that's exactly right. And you know, I've said this a couple of different times. This feels to me like Christmas shopping with a Christmas card. You know, they're just out, you know, here, let's buy this gift, let's get that one, and they're all wrapped up in pretty bows and underneath the Christmas tree. But that day in January is going to come where it's cold and dark, and you're opening up that bill going, how am I going to pay for this? And you're sick to your stomach going, how am I going to pay for this? Because we have calculated right now all the promises that our opponents have made, and it's $16 billion in additional monies on top of what we are already collecting. And you know who's going to pay for that is the taxpayers. Mm-hmm. And so they're talking about all these free programs, and we're going to expand this. I was at a housing forum with my opponent, and she said, we're going to commit $330 million to housing. Well, then, you know, okay, well, what's going to give? Well, there's nothing that we've heard that they're going to cut out. They're not talking about streamlining programs. They're not talking about efficiencies. Mm-hmm. They're just talking about adding. And that really concerns me, and I'm sure, you know, you as well, or, you know, other listeners as well, that concerns me, because, you know, we pay a lot already in taxes. And, you know, I just don't know how much more I can be squeezed. This is really difficult to see $100 million get shipped over to Somalia, right? Part of the daycare fraud.
Right.
$500 million in, you know, another fraud get shipped out. And then you say, well, who's got their eye on these agencies?
Right.
Because if you're going to expand these programs, you're going to have to make sure that the programs that are there are working, that the money that we're spending is being well spent, you know, that type of thing. And we don't hear that at all from our opponents.
I want to go, you know, we're running up against the need to go to a break, but I want to take another couple minutes, go a little bit longer, just to touch upon your background on your mother's side, the Red Lake Nation, being indigenous, and being a minority in Minnesota. And this is something that, you know, a status that I share with you in terms of being a minority as well in Minnesota, and being a Republican, being a conservative. What is that like, particularly from the perspective of being on the ticket and going around and talking to folks? How often does that aspect of your identity factor into the conversations that you're having with folks, and how does it do so?
Well, I think it really hits people because it's so historic. I don't know that, you know, we necessarily are seeing this talked about because we're Ojibwe. I think if there was another minority, two minorities of the same minority running on the ticket, might be the same conversation, you know, Asian, African American, whatever.
Right.
But because we're the two Ojibwe women, mm-hmm. for the first time ever, you know, that gets talked about. So it's very historic. But I also do like to point out that I'm a retired veteran, right? So I would be the first woman veteran lieutenant governor, and so kind of try to wedge that into the conversation as well. But I'm certainly very proud of my heritage, and my mother born and raised on the Red Lake Nation, you know, reservation. Bless her cotton socks. It was tough going. You know, she was born in 38, and, you know, 50s were hard times to be on reservations. And when she was 18, you know, she knew she wanted to leave. She wanted opportunities. She wanted a better future for her children, because at that time the reservations were really dire, you know, places to be in Minnesota, from our nation anyway, from Red Lake. And so You know, she moved off, but she, you know, she didn't want to abandon her heritage.
Right.
And so I still talk about, you know, how her upbringing, you know, translates down to us and how, you know, we share her values. So I didn't grow up on the reservation, but we certainly grew up knowing, you know, that we were part of this bigger picture, which I always say, you know, that ties me to this place. This is my home. You know, I'm not going to go anywhere. When I joined the military, I knew that I was defending, you know, my homeland, not only my, you know, dad's immigrant family's, you know, chosen home, but also, you know, the home that my mom's people had been from for generations. And, you know, that feels really good. But it does come up a lot, and I think it's really neat. I think it's historic. And I think that, you know, for me, it's part of me, but it's not the only, you know, that's not the only thing I bring to the table.
Very much appreciate you joining us tonight. Donna Bergstrom, you can find out more about the campaign at johnsonforgovernor.org. And we're looking forward to seeing the fight come to a climax here on November 6th.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you, Walter, for having me on your show. This was wonderful. And have a good rest of the evening.
Best of luck to you. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us this evening. Freestyle Friday will take the show in whatever direction you choose. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
Inform it.
Got done talking with Donna Bergstrom, the candidate for lieutenant governor, running alongside Jeff Johnson as a Republican, seeking your vote in less than 20 days. We're almost down to two full weeks before Election Day here in Minnesota and across the country. Don't quite know yet. There are some rumors that are being passed around the office here regarding what we're going to have in terms of coverage on election night. Some good things potentially in the works. I'm actually a little unclear and a little bit concerned as to why I haven't heard more.
And that's new to either of us about communication around here.
Yeah, I'm sure there probably is. It's all laid out and just nobody's told me.
We just haven't heard about it.
That's in fact, I'm 100% certain that that's exactly what the case is.
So stay tuned, everybody.
Stay tuned. Something will definitely be happening on election night. It's going to be more than just your typical closing argument. And there's probably going to be a lot more people in the studio or elsewhere, perhaps. Perhaps we'll go on tour. Perhaps we'll be out and about. So that'll be fun. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. My name's Walter Hudson. Let's talk to Dan in Hopkins. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Walter. Yeah, it was great. That was a great interview. Great questions. You know, I heard Jeff Johnson say that he didn't choose Donna because she was a woman or because she was Native, but because she was the most highly qualified person he thought for the position. And I didn't know a tremendous amount about Donna, certainly at first.
Mm-hmm.
But with her background and her education and her real sincere, she's just a sincere and very calm person.
Yeah.
And very intelligent.
Yeah, you can definitely tell she's thoughtful. She's, you know, that's the thing. Being in a position, and not just the position that I have now of being a commentator, having a radio show, but, you know, having been an activist and getting around the proverbial block and talking to a lot of politicians, a lot of candidates, a lot of incumbents. Unfortunately, the norm is for people to kind of be lost in the woods a little bit. You know, they know they want to have the office, whatever the office it is that they're seeking. They know they want it, and they have a vague idea of why they want it. But if you press them on it, they can't really tell you. They can't get too deep into the details of why it's so important or what they're going to do once they get there. Donna doesn't seem like that. She seems like she has a good grasp on what the fight is and how to pursue it.
Yeah, and she has such a profound background. In other words, being a part of the Red Lake, you know, nation by her mother and Swedish immigrant family on her father's side, she has a healthy balance, especially, you know, as it pertains to all those issues. She did share with me once, I had a chance to talk to her, that the Indian peoples who generally vote Democrat seem to lose sight of the fact that they want to maintain the right to bear arms and protect themselves as a nation. And they are, she is, and I'm with her. I mean, I think that we need to honor the treaties that were signed. And, you know, so there's a real healthy balance where, you know, I think that in perspective that she gives to that, where unlike in the maybe the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, where the Democrats have kind of given them free rein over the lake, she says, you know, there are boundaries, and there's boundaries that are established, and that despite the fact that I'm an American Indian or Native, you know, we need to honor those boundaries, and we expect those boundaries to be honored on our behalf as well. You know what I'm saying? It seems just a real level-headed, calm, thoughtful, poised approach.
I appreciate it, Dan. Appreciate you calling on the program. Let's talk to Sam in Plymouth. Welcome to Closing Argument.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Walter. Yep. So I would like to maybe ask what you mean by, like, insignificant with violence on the right versus on the left. I'd ask that question in a comment, but, you know, I'm a member of the Muslim community, and it seems to me like there is a significant amount of right-wing violence, although I will agree that there's a significant difference with maybe leadership, but I wouldn't call right-wing violence insignificant. You know, there was the bombing of the mosque. There was the campaign whose, you know, it hinged on Islam being incompatible with the Constitution. And I don't think we have to go too far down the logic to that making policy. And then, you know, there have been a lot of attempted terrorist attacks where maybe I'm just too close to the issue because I'm a member of that minority. But I wouldn't say right-wing violence isn't insignificant.
I'll tell you what. Do you have the capacity to stick with us through a break and then come back and get to it? Because I did not anticipate how deep the topic was going to be when I brought you on here.
If you're willing to have me, I'm willing to stay.
All right. Sounds great. We'll come back on the other side of the bottom of the hour news, and we'll get into comparing and contrasting right-wing and left-wing violence. 651-989-5855. My name's Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. 24. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, Closing Argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Freestyle Friday, taking the program in whatever direction you choose, streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. To join us and steer the ship, call 651-989-5855. Brianne taking those calls and producing the show for us. We got Sam from Plymouth on the line, and before we went to break, you teed up the topic, and I wanted to give us some more time to really flesh it out because it's a big topic, and that is the role of violence in our politics, which is something that's been a recurring topic here on the program, and I have made the point that to my mind, there's a difference, there's a disparity between the quality and prominence of violence and advocacy for violence between the right and the left, and you've taken issue with that. And a couple of things that you've pointed out, or as we went to the break, was the bombing of the mosque in Bloomington, the Dar al-Farouk Center, which took place, what was it, last year? And also, what was the other thing you brought up?
I also brought up the campaign wherein the statement was made several times, Islam and law that are not compatible with the Constitution.
Right. That's a reference to Phil Parrish, who was seeking the Republican endorsement for governor in this state this year. So I'll go ahead and let you kind of restate your premise, and then we'll dig into it here a little bit.
Right. So I think so maybe this is just semantics and I'm not quite understanding you well enough, but when we talk about significance versus insignificance of violence on the right versus the left, I don't think it's insignificant on the right, although I will concede, and I agree with you, that there is a difference between what the left is doing with what's going on and what the right is doing, but the presence of it is still there. Now, maybe because I'm a member of a community that often feels embattled, I see it more often. But, you know, there are lots of terrorist attacks that have been thwarted against my community in other states, like the one in Kansas, the one against Islamburg, where massacres were planned by people who identified themselves as the right. And I don't think right-wing violence is insignificant. I just think that left-wing violence is maybe becoming more a part of their leadership.
So I'm assuming that, because you've used the word significance quite frequently here, and the only place so that I can recall having used that term recently was, I think yesterday I brought up what I called the inversion of significance. And what I mean by that, you know, I do not at all mean to suggest that the actual violence is insignificant or comparing the quality of the actual violence. What I'm talking about is the significance of where it's being, where it's originating from, and who's calling for it and advocating for it. So on the right, you know, you've mentioned Phil Parrish, for example. Now, Phil Parrish is significant in the sense that he was a candidate seeking the Republican endorsement for governor. But let's be honest, literally anybody can do that, right? Like, there's no, you don't have to pass some test or pass some scrutiny in order to put yourself forward, put your name in the hat to be considered for an endorsement. And his campaign got nowhere. He gained no traction whatsoever. He was broadly condemned on the basis of what he was calling for in terms of, you know, his marginalization of the Muslim community. As far as the Dar al-Farouk bombing, which took place, I'm unaware of anybody in any position of prominence. And that's what I mean by significance. People in positions of prominence, people with institutional authority, people who actually have a following that could be considered to be mainstream, who condone that or celebrated it or encouraged it or are calling for more incidents like it. As far as I could see, it's broadly condemned. And the places, when I talk about significance, I'm saying that the places where this is coming from are, they're coming from insignificant fringe people. And anybody can say they're on the right. And of course, you know, when you look at, for instance, when you look at the alt-right, the reason why they call themselves the alt-right is because they want to try to hijack the significance of being on the right. They want to have that legitimacy of associating with something that is, that doesn't want them and is bigger than them and distinct from them.
Yeah, I hear your point. And I mean, I think it's a very good point. I would debate maybe if there wasn't significance for the campaign, for Phil Parrish's campaign. And I'm not saying that he directly called for violence. He did not. But if he had that opinion, and if that opinion becomes policy and the state essentially is violence.
You're speaking my language there. So absolutely.
Yeah. You know, and I was at the convention, and when he said, you know, that catchphrase, it got a really big round of applause from people who were, you know, not necessarily wearing his shirt. Uh-huh. So I guess that might just be anecdotal, and maybe
what's the catchphrase?
Islam and Sharia are completely incompatible with the Constitution.
Right. And look,
which, I mean, it's also nonsense, but that's a different conversation.
It is, and it's a conversation we've had on this program. And I, and look, there is, that is an idea that needs to be confronted and needs to be rejected, because the way in which he means that is basically a denial of the status of Islam as a religion. And, you know, we've had this conversation with both Parrish and folks who are of the same mind, where basically the argument they're trying to make is the First Amendment doesn't apply to Islam because it's not actually a religion. It's some sort of subversive political system, which, yeah, you know, we, like you say, we could go down a rabbit hole getting into that. And I don't see a lot of utility in that tonight, but the point that I'm trying to make is that people are scared. They're absolutely scared. And I understand why they're scared, and we have a responsibility to confront the fear. The difference, as I see it, in terms of calls for violence, is that you don't see an analog on the right. You don't see an analog on the right in terms of Nancy Pelosi telling people to get mobs together to confront people, Maxine Waters telling people to get people together and harass members of the administration when they see them out in public. We got another story in the stack here tonight of a professor who's telling his students that they need to walk up to conservatives as they're eating their salad in the restaurant and stick their whole fingers in the salad and what have you. Like, the prominence of it, the frequency of it, and the places where the significance of the places where it's coming from, just to my mind, is completely lopsided.
Right. I think maybe the gulf is that I'm maybe putting more significance, to use that word, unfortunately, again, on the grassroots and what I maybe see in grassroots voices. And I think the last election proved that grassroots is very powerful, and everybody, you know, ideas at the level of person to person, not leadership down in the new political sphere of things, are very powerful. And I'm, you know, Nancy Pelosi and all those thought leaders, they're cresting this leftist revolutionary wave. And yeah, you know, I'll have to concede your point on that. There's more leadership that supports that. But I don't think that there is insignificance, or, you know, that there's not necessarily prominence on the grassroots level for certain calls to violence from the right. Maybe that's just what I see, and I'll have to concede that, you know, my viewpoint might be,
I don't know. You know, look, I'll give you this. To my mind, because what I see from my perspective as somebody who is kind of, you know, straddling the line between insider and outsider, I can never quite tell which camp I'm in. What I hear a lot of people who are extraordinarily frustrated with the type of rhetoric that you're referencing, that they hear from the grassroots, from within, you know, activist circles, Facebook pages, what have you, but they feel like they can't say anything about it because of the positions that they're in. So I'm talking about people who are like staffers for, you know, various incumbents or campaigns, or people who are party officers or what have you. They feel as though they don't have the ability to really speak out because they're going to be accused of being partial, you know, because they have a responsibility to either protect their candidate or to run their BPOU or whatever the case may be. And they just want to be they want to keep their head down is basically the deal. Now, is that an excuse? I don't think so. It's not. But it is an explanation. And the point that I'm trying to drive at is that I don't think that the views themselves are as widespread as the rhetoric you're hearing might indicate. And that the real need is for the people who oppose those views to take a stronger and louder stance against it.
Yeah, and I think you're definitely right. And I have experienced some of that myself, you know, as I've become more involved in politics. But, you know, it's something that as people on the right, you know, because I consider myself to be on the right, a libertarian Republican, we need to also understand how that rhetoric is going to affect the current ideological war we're in, you know?
That's absolutely right.
Because Antifa justifies their actions by comparing themselves to people who fought actual Nazis in Germany.
Right.
And then they trot out Gavin McInnes to say, yes, see, and then Gavin McInnes is this person, is that person.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, maybe I'll have to definitely rethink my position on, you know, what the actual significance of that rhetoric is, especially based on what you said. But, you know,
I think the left
is definitely embracing revolutionary violent rhetoric.
I think it's important, to your point, it's important that we maintain the insignificance that it currently has and to continue to push back again. And that's why, you know, one of the things that I got, and I appreciate the call, Sam, appreciate you calling in the program. One of the pushbacks that I got when I was going after Phil Parrish as hard as I was during the endorsement process was, and this wasn't even from his supporters, this was from other people. Why are you giving him so much prominence? Why are you talking about him? Why are you shining a spotlight on this? This guy is a fringe character who's not indicative of where the Republican Party's at. By talking about him, you're making him out to be a bigger deal than he actually is. And my counter to that was, yeah, you're right. He's not representative of where the mainstream Republican Party is. He's not representative of where most self-identified conservatives are at and how they think and how they feel. However, when this type of thing pops up, specifically for the reasons that Sam cites, it's important that the rest of us shout it down and distinguish ourselves from it so that the point is made that this is not who we are. If we just sit here and we're quiet about it and we don't acknowledge it and we don't condemn it, then the assumption is going to be, well, you must agree with it. And, you know, if you want an example of how that dynamic works, just look at every time some sort of terrorist activity takes place involving Muslims. What do we say? We say, well, why aren't all the moderate Muslims coming out to say they disagree with the bombing that just took place? And, you know, if we're going to think that way about them, that, hey, if something heinous is done or said, then people of good character need to come out and condemn it. If we're going to apply that standard to them, then the standard also applies to us. We have to stand up and say, no, what folks like Parrish are saying is wrong. What folks like Bob Corello are saying is wrong. You know, when this notion that the Constitution precludes the practice of Islam in the United States is wrong and needs to be pushed back on. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hatson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
Sean.
Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, 651-989-5855, the number to join us. Freestyle Friday going into your weekend. We'll take the show in whatever direction you want to steer it. Let's talk to Tyson from Minneapolis. Welcome to the program.
Walter, how are you?
Good.
Long-time caller, first-time listener, man. I listen to you guys every night that I can, and I just want to let you know I really appreciate the topics you bring to the forefront. And I think it's always right in the middle where it needs to be, and I just want to let you know I appreciate that.
I appreciate you listening and your kind comments.
So stay with me for a second, because I've been thinking about this for about 10 minutes, and I want to make sure that it makes sense. So Donald Trump shows up, and he is absolutely outlandish, and he says things that are controversial, and he says things that kind of punch you in the mouth a little bit, and those things made Donald Trump relevant. And on the other hand, when nobody's paying attention, Donald Trump is getting things done,
right,
putting perspective for people. When he was showing them the right hand, he was doing things with the left.
Mm-hmm.
And in this analogy, he is the great and powerful Oz, right? Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. So what the Democrats realize is that it made him relevant. And when it made him relevant, he became important. When it became important, people listened. And when they listened, they voted. And so now they're understanding that they can say crazy things that don't mean anything to them and that fire up the base underneath of them, just like it happened with Kavanaugh and just like when Hillary Clinton said those ridiculous things about civility, which was almost identical to a speech that Adolf Hitler made when he said, "We can be civil when the war is won." Almost identical.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that she has the ability to do that is because, you know, the seal has been broken, right? You can say anything you want as long as it makes you relevant now. It gets you TV time. It gets you radio time. Michael Avenatti, a nobody, a piece of garbage who you know, does nothing but create this absolute chaos, and he used chaos as a ladder to put him in position where now people are thinking he's going to run for president in 2020.
Yeah, right.
It's ridiculous, right? But the point is that he's used this rhetoric,
mm-hmm,
that absolutely crazy, and any intelligent person is going to listen to this guy and go, this guy's out of his mind. Nobody's going to take him seriously. But you don't have to be taken seriously anymore to be important. You don't have to be taken seriously anymore for people to listen to you. And that's unfortunately the world that we're living in. And I wanted to kind of get your thoughts on that. And what are we going to do to get rid of that and create some kind of order now where people are going to actually listen to reason, instead of, you know, believing some person that you've never met before with no evidence, you know, to destroy someone else's life for no reason? It's just, to me, it's absolutely absurd.
As I listen to you talk about it, and you paint a very vivid picture, and I appreciate it, I wonder what the missing piece is, because it occurs to me that if the Democrats and the left more generally are trying to emulate Trump, which seems to be what you're suggesting, that they're saying, well, it worked for him to be outrageous, so let's be outrageous. If that's what's taking place, I don't perceive that it's working for them. And the question becomes, why isn't it working for them? Why did it work for Trump, but it won't work for Hillary Clinton? Why does it work for Trump, but it won't work for Nancy Pelosi or for a lot of Republicans? Because there have been a lot of Republicans who have tried to emulate Trump's style, and it hasn't panned out for them. And I can't quite put my finger on what the difference is. I'll try to think about it over the break, and maybe we'll come back at the top of the hour and I'll have some sort of profound insight. But I think much more likely it's going to continue to remain a mystery, because Trump has tapped into something that is uniquely of him, and I don't think it's going to translate to other Republicans, and certainly not to Democrats. Appreciate your call, Tyson. Hope you call back 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. Freestyle Friday closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
Thanks for listening.
I may actually have that profound insight. I doubted I was going to be able to come up with it, but over the break, I think I actually hit upon something. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. It is Friday. That means Freestyle Friday. We'll take the show in whatever direction you want to steer it. To do so, call 651-989-5855. Brianne is in, taking those calls and producing the show for us tonight. So we had Tyson. It was Tyson, right, who called in? Last segment at the bottom of the hour. And he asked about Donald Trump, and he kind of painted this picture whereby the candidacy of Donald Trump, the ascendancy of Donald Trump, established this precedent whereby, you know, he said these outrageous things that drew attention and drew the spotlight. And once he had the attention, that led to, you know, getting people to listen to him. And once he got people to listen to him, that led to people wanting to vote for him. And it kind of established this sort of formula. And perhaps what's happening with the Democrats right now and the extent to which they are openly advocating for violence. You've got Nancy Pelosi saying that we need to have, it's okay if there's collateral damage to people who disagree with the left-wing agenda. You've got Maxine Waters telling people to get crowds together and confront members of this administration and conservatives more generally out in the public. You've got a professor that we got a piece in the stack here who is advocating for his students and the left to stick their whole fingers. That's the direct quote. Stick your whole fingers in their salad at the restaurant. That's just insane stuff. Just absolutely ridiculous. And the premise put forward by Tyson is perhaps what they're doing is they're taking their cue from Donald Trump. Donald Trump said outrageous things. And he did that as a means to an end. And if you judge him based upon what he's accomplished, what he's actually done in office, as opposed to the outrageous things that he said, you're going to come to two very different conclusions. Like, he has governed like a tremendous conservative. And he has. He's governed like a Republican president should govern for the most part. You know, I've got nits to pick. But certainly better than you would have expected from Mitt Romney, right? Certainly better than you would have expected from John McCain. Trump has done a good job. And so if you're going to judge him based upon what he's done versus what he said, those are going to be two very different judgments. And so perhaps something similar is happening with the Democrats. And so here's my attempt at a profound insight in considering Tyson's premise. It occurs to me that to the extent the Democrats are trying to hijack or co-opt Trump's methodology of saying outrageous things in order to earn media and activate their base and try to mimic or duplicate a Trump effect on the left to work for them to get their voters out, it's obviously not working. I mean, we saw that with the confirmation battle over Brett Kavanaugh, with the shift in the polling where enthusiasm amongst Democratic women went down, enthusiasm amongst Republican women went up, the job approval rating for Donald Trump hit 50, right? Like, it's amazing how much the Democrats are tripping all over their own feet in the aftermath of Kavanaugh. And I don't think that their cries for violence and their outrageous behavior and their outrageous rhetoric has been gaining them a lot of traction outside of hardcore leftist circles. And so why is that? Why does what works for Trump not work for the left? I think it comes down to a couple of things. Number one is sales, the concept of sales, because that's what's taking place here, right? Like, if you talk about the way Trump sold himself in 2016 versus the way Democrats are selling themselves now, you can, they both involve the same techniques, sales techniques, right? But here's the thing about sales. If the underlying value of what it is that you're selling isn't actually there, ultimately, it doesn't matter what technique you bring to the table, right? You can have the most outstanding rhetorical delivery. You can have all of the different tricks, all the showmanship that you want. But if the widget that you're slinging doesn't do what you say, if it doesn't actually have a tangible value for the lives of the people who you're asking to buy it, it doesn't matter. You might get a couple sales here or there, but sooner or later, people are going to realize that you're selling them a lemon, right? And I think that's what's happening with the Democrats. We got it. When I got another piece in here that we might get to here this hour, talking about the Black community and how there's something happening. There's an opportunity that is rising within the Black community where they're walking away from the Democrats. They're walking away from the left, and they're seeking something different. They're being activated by the likes of Candace Owen, who is taking action to try to capitalize on this awakening that's taking place. And the reason why is exactly this reason. It's the authentic value of what the Democrats are selling, or the lack thereof, the lack of authentic value in terms of what they're selling versus what is actually required. Now, with Donald Trump, you almost have the opposite. Like, he's in some cases doing a poor job of selling himself, in some cases doing a poor job of putting his best rhetorical foot forward. But the tangible value, the authentic value of what he's actually delivering on sells itself. And so it's almost an inversion, right? And so you can't, this idea that you can look at a good salesman, you can look at a good businessman, and you just mimic what he does and you're going to copy the success. That's not true. The underlying value of what is being offered in the transaction has to be there. And the Democrats aren't providing that. Another aspect of this comparison between Trump and the Democrats that I think is worth taking a look at. One of the things that you heard people say in the aftermath of Trump's victory in 2016 was that Trump's supporters took him seriously, but not literally, while his critics took him literally, but not seriously. And I think there's an absolute truth to that. There's an absolute truth to that. You know, certainly I fell in the category of the critic who took him literally and not seriously. I didn't take his campaign seriously, and I criticized everything that he said as though he actually meant it word for word. Turns out, you know, he was selling. He was spinning, right? And the actual truth of what it was that he was pursuing and what he was delivering, we've seen over the past 2 years, but, you know, you can only judge something based upon the words that you hear at the time. With the Democrats, what I think is different is that when they use their outrageous rhetoric, it's not rhetorical. Like, they're not trying to be outrageous. They're serious. They are both serious and literal. When they say, take to the streets, get in their face, get a crowd together, stick your full fingers in their salad, they mean that. They're serious about it, and they literally mean it. And so there is no nuance. There is no showmanship. And I think that as consumers of this rhetoric, we can detect that, right? Like with Trump, and I heard expressions to this effect in 2016. People would say, Trump, early adopters of Donald Trump would say, well, you can't take what he's saying, you know, literally. You have to take it with a grain of salt. And I would come back and I'd be like, what do you mean I can't take it literally? Like, that's ridiculous. Of course, I have to take it literally. What other choice do I have? And they're like, no, you don't understand. You can't take it literally. He's just saying it that way because it's got an impact, because it gets an applause line. What he's actually going to do is this. He's actually going to go in this different direction. It's going to be something different. Just wait and see, right? And to me, that was kind of nuts, but it turns out to be true. Like, Donald Trump does not speak in literal terms. He uses figurative language to try to paint a rhetorical picture that is symbolic of what it is that he actually wants to do. He doesn't speak in literal terms. And obviously his supporters came to understand that. People came to perceive that there's an underlying meaning to the things Trump is saying. Juxtapose that to the Democrats. There's no symbology. There's no figurative language or symbolism in what the Democrats are saying when they're advocating for violence, when they're advocating for taking to the streets. They are dead serious, and you can tell. You can perceive the seriousness of Nancy Pelosi's comment about collateral damage for those who disagree with the leftist worldview as she says it. This is something you pick up on. There's this natural human instinct where you can detect the malevolence or sincerity or authenticity in the person that you hear speaking to you. You know, it's an intuition, if you will. And that's one of the key differences I would point to in terms of the way Trump pursued his campaign in 2016 versus how the Democrats are pursuing their midterm campaigns here in 2018. They are both serious and literal. They are not delivering something that has authentic value. They're scammers, and people are waking up to the scam and detecting the malevolence in their offer. Let's talk to Mike in Farmington. Appreciate you calling the program.
Thanks for taking my call, Walter. If you would indulge me, I'm gonna just try to lay a little groundwork to kind of give you some depth on how I think we're Catholic here. And I'll go back to 9/11, and we talked about these people that got access to these planes, and there was all these questions. George Bush said, we're going to have this war. And we were wondering, well, how did these people get into the country, and what went on here? And we spent all this money going to war. Then I'll fast forward to, I think it was later, about 2004, 2006. There was a bus accident, I believe, down in Cottonwood, Minnesota. And some school children were killed when a woman ran her van into the side of this bus. What ended up happening is the story was reported. I believe three kids were killed. We found out, this woman was in the country illegally. So I thought, well, this is odd. We're going to war. We're fighting against these terrorists and these people that shouldn't have been in the country, because we found out the FBI and the authorities didn't talk to each other. Mm-hmm. Then I started wondering, why are we getting these people in the country illegally? What's going on? So that piqued my interest, and I started researching how many crimes were going on with people that didn't belong in the country. So I didn't see a consistency in value there. In other words, we're going to war, and we're going to spend a lot of money, but yet there's all these people in the country illegally. Now, if you remember, when Trump started to chime in, he'd be on Fox News and talk about things like OPEC. He talked about things like China. And when he came out and he came down that staircase, he talked about people that are in the country illegal.
Right, yeah.
Now, I think there was a fundamental sense by the people that the government really wasn't interested in honoring the contract of its citizens.
Right.
Keeping the citizens safe, they were kind of in it for themselves, and people felt disenfranchised, and that grew and grew over the election.
Yeah.
Here comes the guy that, I'll use two words, genuine and authentic. He is who he is.
Right.
And he said those things that I think a lot of people felt, and they looked at this guy and said, you know what? What we've been doing hasn't really worked.
Mm-hmm.
The Bushes and the Clintons, what do we have to lose by following this guy? He is who he is, and you just can't put that in a bottle and try to repackage that.
Yeah. I appreciate the call, Michael, as always, and I think you're definitely onto something. That goes to the point that I was making regarding the authentic value of what it is that you're selling. And, you know, as somebody who, and perhaps I'll expound upon this a little bit more when we come back from the other side of the break, but throughout my tenure as a Tea Party activist from 2008, you know, through to 2012, 2014, there was the issue of immigration, which was never something that I personally cared about all that much. To me, it wasn't really relevant to what the Tea Party was about, even though I knew there were a lot of people within the Tea Party who cared about it very deeply. the issue was always there, and it was something that people were always talking about, and it was something that people were obviously passionate about, and there was literally nobody who was taking those concerns seriously. And that is a void. That desire for somebody to take the people's concerns seriously was so profound and so innate that when Donald Trump came on the scene and it was his number one thing, it was the first thing he said, like Michael says, when he came down the stairs, first thing he said, that there was almost no wrong he could do after that point. Because here's a guy who, unlike anybody else on that stage of 16 other candidates, is actually going to give credence to these concerns that nobody else has had the willingness to give any time to or shed any light on. And, you know, regardless of how you personally feel about immigration, it's testament to the power of the grassroots and the necessity to actually address the perceived concerns and perceived values of the electorate. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
The Joe Pack.
Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. 651-989-5855. The number to join us on this Freestyle Friday. Doesn't matter what the topic is, we'll go wherever. It's 10:30. It's Friday night. I mean, you can bring up anything. I'll talk about it for the most part. I'm interested in. I might regret opening up this can of worms, but I'm interested in testing my own limits as to what what topic I won't talk about. So
I think you have a pretty high threshold anyway. So. I'd really like to see how dark this gets.
Honestly, the whole freestyle thing is kind of a lie, because it's not like there's any, like Monday through Thursday, I'm so selective in terms of which calls I take.
Not at all.
But, you know, it's just, whatever standard I do have, it's even looser on Friday night. So there you go. 651-989-5855 is the number. So at the end of the show last night, I started talking about this story and Reason, where they're talking about the demise of Sears, and which, you know, you could fill in the blank with any department store, but Sears is perhaps the most prominent chain that is going under. And it's interesting, you know, I was in the cities today, and I was walking by some historical photos that showed when Sears was opening in this particular location in Minneapolis. And they were talking about how they had demolished something. I don't know what it was, but they had demolished something in order to put the Sears there. Which, the first thing I'm thinking of is, wow, like that's literally what's happening now. It's like Sears is getting demolished to put something else in. And, you know, this is not new. This the notion of the market coming up with a new and better way of doing something. Department stores were themselves an innovation. They were themselves an advancement in terms of how products were distributed and, you know, bringing things closer to the people, having a broader selection, more choice, and a faster delivery system, faster distribution.
A tale as old as capitalism.
A tale as old as capitalism that will only end when we dispense with capitalism. And that's the point that they make here at Reason, is that, you know, before Amazon, before Walmart, there was Sears, one of the very first retailers built to sell just about anything to just about anyone. Its demise offers a lesson in the history of American retail and the value of creative destruction. Founded more than 130 years ago, Sears, Roebuck & Company initially sold through a mall order catalog. Eventually, the company opened a fleet of stores across America, becoming one of the nation's most successful retail enterprises. But the stores struggled to keep up with the changing retail environment brought on by big box competitors like Home Depot and Best Buy, which devoted Sears-sized stores to a single retail category, providing far greater selection in the process. Walmart, meanwhile, used its buying power to sell goods at deep discounts and offered grocery sales, luring in daily customers that Sears struggled to reach. Finally, Amazon, with its online ordering, massive selection, relatively low prices, and speedy delivery, turned the retail industry upside down in some ways by relying on an internet era version of the catalog strategy that Sears started with so many decades ago. And, you know, again, the theme here being this is how the market works. Creative destruction. With the emphasis on creative, the emphasis on you're getting a higher value after the process. Now, what's lost in the mix here is nostalgia. And this is kind of what we ended the show on last night, is this, and you know, you might not know it from listening to me night after night here on the program. We don't really talk too much about issues where this would come up or would seem particularly evident, but I tend to be a fairly nostalgic guy, tend to be fairly sentimental. And, you know, I like the past. I like my past. I like going back to my hometown and driving around. You know, I'm one of those dads who's pointing out to the kids, this is the house where dad grew up. This was the park where I played. You know, that sort of thing. And they don't care. I don't think they care at all. Right? Like, there's no interest. It's all about me. It's completely self-indulgent. But that's kind of what nostalgia is. It's kind of just reminding yourself of where you've been, reminding yourself of the way things used to be. And there's something healthy about that when it's kept in its place. But it can also become an anchor that holds you back if you allow yourself to get lost in or rooted to something that has changed and something that you need to move past. And I think communally, societally, the way that this happens is in our desire to try to freeze in amber, in some cases, entire industries whose time has passed, right? Like if it's time to move on to something else, if something doesn't work anymore, you know, light rail comes to mind, right? Streetcars come to mind. If we've moved past something and it no longer provides the highest value at the lowest cost, then it's not something that we should continue to indulge in. Now, nostalgia has its place, right? And there are ways that the market can serve, because nostalgia can become a market unto itself. And one of the ways in which this plays out, to my mind, is when you go to Disney World, for example. Disney World is all about nostalgia. Disneyland. The first thing you see when you walk in those gates, the Magic Kingdom, is Main Street, USA. You know, complete with a steam engine, a choo-choo train making its way across the vista, right? And then Cinderella's castle rising up in the middle. The whole thing is about this fantastical, romanticized vision of the past, the way things used to be. Main Street, USA. And, you know, there are other ways. The Mall of America. The Mall of America will stand as a testament to, or kind of like a temple of American commerce, as unutilitarian as it is. Like, who of us who actually live here in the metro area, who among us goes to the Mall of America because we want to shop at the Mall of America? Like, that, it doesn't happen, right? It doesn't have a utility for us, but it's a tourist attraction more for what it calls us back to than for the value that it actually serves in our day-to-day lives. And the market is good at providing those types of nods to nostalgia. You want to remember what it was like to walk through a department store? We'll provide you with that nostalgia. You want to remember what it was like to walk through a mall, to walk down Main Street, USA? We'll provide that as an entertainment experience, as a tourist attraction. But the idea that we have to actually maintain the real thing, even though its utility has passed, is something I think we need to dispense with and not allow ourselves to succumb to in terms of that temptation. 651-989-5855, closing argument. My name is Walter Essen, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you joining us. Freestyle Friday, little bit looser on our typical topical selection here. You can steer the program in the direction you want to take it, 651-989-5855. The number to join us, Brianne taking those calls and producing the show for us this evening. Let's talk to Scott in Maplewood. Welcome to the program.
Hi, sir.
Hi.
I was listening to you earlier. You were talking about Donald Trump kind of in the beginning of his campaign. He would say something that would get him some attention. Then once he had all the attention, he would lay out something that he really wanted to portray to everybody, and in kind of a way, you know, gaming the system. Someone had posted something on Facebook earlier about why are we so concerned about someone that was murdered in a foreign country, a foreigner murdered in a foreign country, the writer.
Yeah, I don't even know how to pronounce his name, Khashoggi or something along those lines. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, why are we worried about that when we have these people that were killed in Benghazi and some other stuff?
Right.
And right. I kind of put the two and two together, and I thought there are some very nefarious things that have gone on. I'm sure there's a lot more behind the Fast and Furious thing than we know, the Arab Spring connections, the ISIS connections, the Muslim Brotherhood connections, the American interference in the Israeli election, the Egyptian election, and I think even some European elections. And I was wondering, my supposition is that he's just waiting it out until he gets a little bit more support, you know, for the things that he's doing for the common man, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And that way the left can't come out and say, oh, see, he's a big conspiracy theorist and he's, you know, he's just trying to deflect attention from himself. You know what I'm saying? Does that make any sense at all?
I'm not sure I'm following you. Like, when you say he's waiting for support, what you mean support in terms of polling? What are you talking about?
Well, the more and more he is winning. I mean, you know, every time I look on Facebook, someone's posting something else that he has signed or done, you know, and it's just a win, a win, a win. And who loses? I don't know that there's a loser.
So,
all these things that he's
when
doing.
I talked to Scott, when we were talking earlier, you kind of made the point that he's kind of laying the trap and he's waiting for all these pieces to kind of be aligned, you know, with Kavanaugh or what have you, you know, to kind of maybe go after these more nefarious, conspiratorial, whatever things.
My guess is, as obvious as some of these heinous things are, he may be waiting until there's a little bit more of a bedrock of support underneath of him.
I see what you're saying.
I don't know, but I guess flipping that around, I couldn't imagine not at least having some groundwork being broken at this point. I mean, there's just so much to some of these things. And
yeah, I tend to not subscribe to the notion that Trump is engaged in some sort of four-dimensional chess, that he has this incredible plan to, you know, accomplish something that the rest of us don't understand. I think it's a much simpler explanation for interpreting Trump, and I appreciate the call, Scott. You know, my interpretation of Trump, I think he's told us what his methodology is. I think he's told us what his experience has been. He has openly talked about how this job is not what he thought it would be, that the swamp is so much worse than he expected, that the pushback that he's getting is overwhelming. I mean, he doesn't put it in those terms because he's not, you know, he likes to portray strength and he likes to kind of brush things off and act as though he can take it, which he can. But if you read beneath the surface, read between the lines, and pick up what it is that he's putting down, he has been under sustained assault. And I think the Russia thing in particular is something that obviously has hit him below the belt and continues to hit him below the belt. And he's very frustrated with it. He's expressed his frustration with it. He wants to focus on the things he wants to do. He wants to focus on his agenda. And he feels as though he's never really had the good opportunity to do that. And if a time is coming where he is going to make a more sustained focus push on his agenda, and that involves certain things such as Scott brought up, I think it's going to have less to do with some sort of master strategic plan that is in play than it does with the fact that he's just getting used to the job. He's getting used to the fact that of how things work, and he's learning how to negotiate it, and he's adapting. I think that's probably more likely what we're seeing happening, as opposed to there being some sort of, you know, master stroke 4D chess plan taking place. Let's talk to Chuck in Crystal. Welcome to the program. Chuck, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
Doing good.
Well, a little while ago, you were talking about nostalgia and the way some things used to be.
Yep.
And I run a small letterpress printing operation in Crystal, and I'm still running hot metal typesetting from machines called Linotypes. And just recently, a gentleman gave me the last front page for the Minneapolis Star and Tribune set in Linotype.
Mm. Wow. That's so fascinating.
Quite a slice of history.
Yeah. You framing that up, or what are you doing with it?
It's already framed up with plastic over the top of it. It's got a brass plaque on it that says what it is.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
the only thing I had to do was pick the 200-pound chunk of lead out of the guy's car and put it in my print shop.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. No, those are cool. I've seen those in other, like in office buildings. I think there's an office. Well, it might actually be the Star Tribune office that has.
Yeah, they've got an intertype machine sitting in their foyer.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Those are some cool things to look at. I appreciate the call, Chuck. Appreciate the contribution. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's, and being a father to young children, especially nowadays where technology is moving forward so quickly, I think really hammers home to you how easily history is lost, how easily things are taken for granted, how people don't even understand. I mean, the extent to which, if the apocalypse happened, if the EMP went off, you know, if the zombies rose or whatever, the extent to which those of us who were left behind would have no idea how anything worked.
Or no way to look it up either.
Or how to fix it, or yeah, no way to look it up. We'd have to start from scratch. We would probably literally have to reinvent the wheel.
There'd be nothing to read.
Yeah.
Nothing to listen to.
Right. We wouldn't know where to find the leftovers of a library. Yeah, I mean, it's problematic. And so you need to find that balance. I think that those of us who are cursed / blessed with a passion for history and a passion for the way things used to be, you know, there's definitely a practical utility in having that interest and just to have that connection to document things accurately and to potentially, you know, be there to explain how things work if the need arises. But also we need to be forward thinking and progressive in the true sense of the word, and realizing that the new fangled way of doing things, if it has a higher value for a lower cost, is a moral imperative. That we ought to be doing things better because it facilitates a greater and more sustainable and thriving life, which is really what the point is here on planet Earth. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Brianne shared this story with me last night, and it's a difficult concept to convey over the air, particularly if you are not familiar with the reference. But there's this meme that's going around. The kids are all the rage with it, you know? It's called the NPC meme. And what NPC stands for, if you're a gamer, you'll find it familiar. It's a non-player character. So you're in a game and, you know, let's say, you know, what a popular game that, you know, a lot of people are familiar with, World of Warcraft. So the characters that you walk up to who give you the quests, or a companion character who goes along with you on the quest, that's an NPC. So somebody who, a character who is scripted, who has pre-programmed responses and is programmed for a very specific purpose to say very specific things in order to fill out the story of the game. So this idea, this concept of an NPC, a non-player character, is being used in memes on the internet in reference to lefties. And it is driving them nuts, which is hilarious. Not only is it driving them nuts, and apparently some people have actually been banned on Twitter for using this meme because it supposedly dehumanizes people by referring to them as NPCs, referring to them as, you know, characters who are just offering pre-scripted, unthinking responses, which, you know, is kind of testament to how bad things have gotten. But I'm just more interested in this, the root concept itself, the idea that, because the more I think about it, the more accurate it is. That's the thing that's so stunning about it, is that how often have you been in a conversation, particularly like a real life conversation where you're face to face and you're actually talking to somebody on the left, and you ask them a question that requires a cognitive response. It requires them to think. It requires them to actually analyze and provide some sort of, to take the information that you're providing them with, combine it with information that they already have, and synthesize an original response. And what you get back is a blank stare, a sense of confusion, and then an eruption of some non sequitur, pre-canned response that is like a bumper sticker or something. This happens all the time to me. It's happened in the studio here. It's happened on the phone. It's happened with people we've had in the studio, where I ask them a question and I get the blank stare, and a couple seconds go by, and then I get a response that has nothing whatsoever to do with what I asked, and indicates that they're having difficulty with the underlying cognitive processes of trying to figure out what it is that we're even talking about. So this NPC thing, I understand why it upsets the left. I get it.
Because it's so accurate.
It's really, really on point. And, you know, doesn't make them look particularly good. So it's pretty fun. We'll tweet it out here. It's over at Breitbart. They talk about it. Kind of hilarious. Kind of hilarious. So Nikki Haley, you know, she retired from her position as ambassador to the United Nations, and she, you know, she's had some remarks at a Alfred E. Smith Memorial Foundation dinner in New York. And, you know, she talked about the toxic political environment, and she kind of put forward, we've been talking here on the program the past couple of weeks, certainly the past few days, about the difference in perception between people who believe that we're still in this kind of good faith place where it's a civil discourse that's taking place, where we all have common values, we just disagree as to the means toward common ends that we're trying to achieve, versus the war that I say is taking place, where we're actually at war for the survival of our republic, for the survival of our individual rights, the integrity of liberty as such. And that what we're at war against is a force of evil. Well, Nikki Haley has a different perspective. She says that true evil is seen in other countries, such as South Sudan or Syria. This is from The Hill. Haley, delivering a keynote address at the aforementioned Alfred E. Smith Memorial Foundation dinner in New York, referred to the current climate as a toxic political environment. She said it has led both parties to describe their opponents as evil, and she added that she warns that what was happening in the United States could not be compared to what she has seen in other countries during her 2 years serving as UN ambassador. She said, in South Sudan, where rape is routinely used as a weapon of war, that is evil. In Syria, where the dictator uses chemical weapons to murder innocent children, that is evil, and so on and so forth. And her point being, there's nothing in the United States that's taking place that rises to that level of horror. And that may be true, absolutely, but that does not mean that what we're up against in terms of what the left prescribes isn't evil. The sort of evil she's talking about in these other countries starts somewhere, and it starts with what we're seeing here. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Broadcasting on 8-